Reach your customers in the places they love to be with Amazon Ads. With an array of channels from Prime Video and Amazon Freevee to Twitch to Amazon Music, Whole Foods Market, and beyond, discover innovative ways to engage audiences and connect content to commerce. Amazon Ads helps you create immersive ad moments for brand marketing, performance, and everything in between. Discover Amazon Ads' new Power of Fandom Research at variety.com/power-of-fandom.
Welcome to Strictly Business, Variety's weekly podcast featuring conversations with industry leaders about the business of media and entertainment. I'm Cynthia Littleton, co-editor-in-chief of Variety. Today, my guest is Peter Kujawski, chairman of Focus Features. Kujawski is a movie lover's movie executive. You can hear in his voice how much he lives and breathes the film business. With Moviedom gathered this week in Las Vegas for CinemaCon, I thought it was a good time for a sit-down with the film veteran to talk about the state of the movie business. You'd be hard-pressed to find a business that has been through tougher circumstances in the past 5 years, between the pandemic, the real estate bubble, and now strike-related movie delays. But the outlook isn't gloomy from where Kujawski sits in his office overlooking the Universal Studios theme park. He believes that recent lessons from the box office indicate that the industry is going into a new golden age of distinctive filmmaking. He has a lot of thoughts about what marketers and exhibitors can do to bring new oomph to the movie-going experience. Peter has a faith that's infectious, as you'll hear right after this break. And now, here's my conversation with Focus Features Chairman Peter Kujawski. Peter Kujawski, Chairman of Focus Features, thank you so much for having me to your beautiful office here. We have a lovely view of a good chunk of the Universal Studios theme park. I guess if you need a little inspiration or a little whimsy in your day, you just look out here and see what's going on with the Minions and Harry Potter and Jurassic World.
Absolutely. I'm like living a childhood fantasy, getting to like look at Super Mario World all day while on my phone calls.
It's a value add to your job. The kind of movies that Focus Features is so well known for, adult movies, mid-budgeted dramas. I don't have to tell you, as we sit here a couple weeks before CinemaCon, that those movies are very challenged right now in the marketplace. That's my perception. As you are the steward of, you know, one of the most well-regarded makers of adult dramas, of movies that really touch the heart and, you know, tell really important stories, how do you feel as you're planning, you know, as you're drawing out your next 3-year plan, your 5-year plan? Do you think that these movies have a future at the old-fashioned box office?
Oh, 100%. And I'd even push back some on the premise of the question, in a sense of, you know, I think if you rewind maybe to about a year and a half ago, or even before that, the recovery of, you know, kind of quote-unquote specialty film was pretty equally mirroring the recovery of, you know, the broader kind of main slate studio movies, commercial films, things like that. And then we got into the fourth quarter in 2022, where I think there was like quite a few, and certainly we had our share of them in that quarter, that didn't connect to the level that you might have anticipated in sort of, quote, the old world, you know, connecting, right? And there was a lot of ink about that out there for sure. And I think a lot of anxiety of, does this represent the turning point that maybe you're referencing of, you know, is this now a permanent state for these movies and things like that? But actually, it really didn't take long for that, you know, kind of brief window to then disappear and to be back on that track of the same sort of rate of recovery that you're seeing in the larger market. Where if you look at, you know, some of the films that came out of Sundance of 23 that weren't ours, you know, you look at what our friends and competitors at A24 were able to do with Past Lives, you know, a really great success story. You know, we feel really proud of what we did with Asteroid City, you know, releasing that right after premiering at Cannes, putting that out in a really eventized sort of release where we had the biggest per screen average of a release for any movie, not only since the pandemic, but I think since going back all the way to La La Land or something like that. You know, it's one of the top per screen opening weekends for a limited release ever, you know, the top five or six or something like that. And then when we went wide with the movie, you had the biggest box office weekend that Wes Anderson has ever had in his career, So it maybe looks and feels different in terms of the pathway to getting there. And certainly I think the bar is higher in terms of what we need to be doing as studios in the space, what, you know, the filmmakers need to be sort of thinking about in the ways that they're going to connect with an audience, that obviously there's a real threshold on still being entertainment forward and being something that I think audiences are going to feel the urgency to go to theaters. But if you have that thing, it's not only coming back, but I think coming back with the potential to maybe be stronger than ever in that space, you know, in so much as you look at the end of the year performance that we had with The Holdovers, that Searchlight had with Poor Things, A24 had with Iron Claw. You know, we look at the sort of rising tide of all of that as great news and something that really points to an audience engagement that, to me, speaks to the broader picture of what's happening culturally right now, right, in the film business in general, where, again, there's maybe a sense that the playbook of, you know, franchise repeatability and the, you know, kind of like spin these characters and stories through all these different versions of themselves, you know, that's now starting to struggle a little bit in a way that, you know, isn't entirely unexpected. And I think everyone's doing a good job to keep that part of the business, like, you know, thriving by being smart to what those movies need to become. But I think it also points to the desire and the appetite for an audience to really have something that feels like an original experience, an experience that has some edge to it, an experience that, you know, is coming from a completely unique voice.
Universal's own Oppenheimer.
Exactly.
Made a little noise last year.
Yeah, you know, and yeah, I mean, you know, you look at like the big cultural story of the movies last year, you know, being the Barbenheimer effect. Both of those things in their way are unexpected, right? You know, they're
wildly
sort of like
original.
Wholly original in terms of like conception and execution. And they were not only embraced, but literally devoured by an audience, right?
True.
So I truly believe, hand on heart, I realize it may sound self-serving given the chair I sit in and things like that, but I truly, truly believe that we might be coming into the very beginning stages of a golden age of, you know, movies that are filmmaker driven, original visions, original voices being the thing that defines the biggest movies of our era, you know, and the sort of most exciting kind of audience experiences of our era, rather than something that you're trying to like find a pathway for, despite the sort of, you know, dominant, you know, kind of brand IP hegemony of an era, like we've had for a while.
I think one thing that's been interesting just from my perspective is seeing going through the pandemic period. And of course, last year with the strike didn't help in terms of pipeline, but seeing that it really is true that that the box office feeds on itself. The idea of like, oh, there's no other features, I'm going to put my movie out. You need it's like a supermarket that only had one brand of toothpaste. Like you can't, you know, people aren't good. At some point they're like, I'm going to go to another store because I don't want that brand. That you need a lot of titles to maintain a robust box office. I think that even in this era when people have many different avenues to get their content, or they're going to wait a few weeks, I'm going to watch it at home. We've all heard the stories of my screen is better, the floors are sticky, all of that. But you're sensing that there's a real hunger out there for these kind of movies, and almost as an offset to the big spectacle, people just want to see a good intimate story, a good comedy story like The Holdovers.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. There's a lot to be said about a few things in there. One is generally a number of movies in the marketplace and the concept of movie going as a habit, right? You know, certainly the big story coming into this year because of the strikes and things like that is just the volume and the reliability of audiences who are still out there, who are the kind of audience who will go to what's playing that weekend, you know? And if you're not providing sort of enough things to sort of satisfy that, yeah, you can kind of make a plan, you know, either every weekend, a couple times a month, whatever it is, to go and you're going to find something for you, then that habit starts to slow down a bit. So we want to be careful as a business to get that back, you know, up and running as quickly as possible. And we know there's structural challenges as to why we're in that moment of time that we are, which aren't permanent is the good news, right? You know, the solution has already happened.
Right. The pipeline issues will eventually. Yeah.
I think, you know, on the level of like types of movies, we actually, you know, have seen real data that says that the most frequent moviegoers, right? The kind of like true habitual moviegoers, not just, you know, ones who are, you know, 4 or 5 times a year, the people right. who go to the movies 12 times a year, 15 right. times a year, they actually rate kind of specialty films, as it were, you know, as a category, among the very highest of movies on the scale of things that they like and go for, you know. But these are people who then also go to all the other movies as well. So there's something about the fact that the most white hot core of theatrical moviegoers actually are largely the people who are the cinephiles who kind of are primarily driven by movies that are original, movies that are completely unique, and also embrace all the rest. It's not that they embrace all the rest and then kind of go around the edges to the rest of the stuff that's out there on the specialty side. So I think, again, like if we as a business enter this kind of phase that I think is coming of a marketplace that is providing more and more things like that on every size, you know, from the low budget end of the spectrum of what we do here at Focus or at other specialty companies, all the way up through the Oppenheimers of the world, you're going to find that muscle memory, you know, developing in an audience to really, you know, I think have an exponential, you know, pathway for people to be at the theater, love that experience of that, want to repeat that experience of that, have seen the trailers for more options to repeat the experience of that, you know, the whole kind of flow of the currents that happens once it's up and running. I think you're going to start to feel that happening in a real way. And obviously, you know, there's going to be the periods where, you know, that's really spiky, right? You know, and certainly I think there was a nice high point in the fourth quarter for this kind of movie. I think in the first quarter, we haven't seen that kind of, you know, cut through happen yet as a sort of breakout specialty box office movie to come along and things like that. But it, to me, doesn't say that it's anything other than that's the natural kind of pattern of movie going rather than a trend that's going to, you know, be with us for the long haul.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a sense in terms of the audience? Obviously, you know, it's an article of faith that teenagers and young people go to the movies on Friday night and Saturday. But is that habit still as strong in the 40, 50 and 60 year olds? If they have, I know 60 is out beyond the demo, but the 40, 50 year olds, that habit is still in there if they see something that they want to see.
Exactly. That's what it is. And the bar is raised for sure about what will be the thing that is worth, you know, buying the tickets the night before to get the good seats to then drive the car and do all the things that, you know, going to see a movie in a theater, you know, asks of you. But there's a real appetite to do that for those things that hit that bar, you know, and, you know, I think that's driven by certainly for that older crowd, that we feel like we've got a good active relationship with on a lot of the films we're making and things we're trying to appeal to them with. You kind of get the sense that once again that are in the flow of doing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
What the takeaway from the theatrical experience is something that we don't, I think, talk enough about as an industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of discussion again because of what the mainstream of movies is
mm-hmm.
of you know, the theatrical experience is the best sound, it's the best visual experience, it's the best, you know, sort of like wrap of the screen in terms of the IMAX experience and all those things, which are real and they're important and they are meaningful to the experience of the movie. What I don't think we talk enough about, though, is the experience of digesting a story as part of a communal response to that story rather than as an individual response to that story. And for that older audience you're speaking of, I think that's actually particularly important. You know, I think, you know, there's a sense that the kind of maturity of the read of knowing that a movie is not just perceived somehow differently by watching it that way.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually a different thing.
It's a different
when you
experience.
Watch it that way. Yeah. Yeah. I go a step further than that. And maybe not to sound bombastic or too philosophical, but the movie is ultimately the thing that you're experiencing in your mind that is what the screen is providing you, bounced off of all the rest of the stuff
yeah.
of life.
Yeah.
Right. So everyone has a different take and experience and actual definitive relationship to a movie that is a different thing to each individual person, right?
Mm-hmm. It's going to hit you where you live
yeah.
in that day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when part of the feedback loop of digesting that film is a recognition of how others are doing that with you,
mm-hmm.
it's just a different movie. It is a different mm-hmm. movie than that same series of images and sounds played, you know, at home on the biggest screen and the best, you know, home theater setup. Mm-hmm. You know, that anyone can have without the wrap of the giggle in the back of the room to the mm-hmm. joke that you didn't quite get was a joke, but now you understand mm-hmm. what it is, mm-hmm. or the sort of gentle gasp of shock or awe of some emotional beat that happens in the movie that hits you differently because it hits someone three rows down differently. You can't recreate that, you know, and I think that is why, to me, theatrical movie going is never going away. You know what I mean? We're not on some like, you know, pathway for that to decay because it's fundamental to how we're meant to digest stories as a peoples.
Since the days of the Greeks, we
exactly.
have gathered. Exactly.
Exactly.
Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back after this short break.
Reach engaged audiences everywhere with Amazon Ads. Tune in with streaming TV fans on Prime Video and Fire TV. Excite shoppers on the hunt for their next favorite thing with sponsored ads. Speak to audiences where they're really listening, like on Amazon Music. Get in the game with live sports superfans with Thursday Night Football on Prime Video. And be a part of the action with streamers and their communities on Twitch. Powered by billions of buying, browsing, and streaming signals that only Amazon can deliver, Amazon Ads helps brands reach customers at every step in their journey, moving them from content to commerce. Discover Amazon Ads' new Power of Fandom research at variety.com/power-of-fandom.
And we're back with more on the future of the movie business from Focus Features Chairman Peter Kujawski.
We came on board the holdovers at the Toronto Film Festival in 22 when they did a buyer screening. It wasn't part of the festival, but it was a screening they set up, and it was a room full of us and, you know, our competitors and things like that. The movie moved us so profoundly, so deeply, you know, and there were great laughs along the way, and it had that full wrap of this movie. And then we were lucky enough to, you know, emerge with the rights to the film and working with Alexander. And we had said our plan is we want to sit tight for a full year, release it this time next year, even though you're sort of basically done the movie. And in the meantime, what we did is, you know, let's put it in front of some other audiences and kind of do some tests to, you know, help craft the campaign as best as possible. And it wasn't until we left the forum of a bunch of film buyers and distributors sitting in a room at a film festival and digesting it in that community and brought it into just a community of regular moviegoers out in Pasadena watching the film that I personally realized that a movie that I thought was funny and full of heart was actually raucously funny. You know what I mean? It was actually like big guffaws funny, you know, and that was this eye-opening moment of, boy, this is really connecting. This is not just like some humor that's sprinkled through this in order to, like, you know, get to this kind of emotional core of the movie. It is this fundamental broad approach to like big laughs that I learned from other people. And it was the same setup. It was a movie theater playing the movie. It was just different communities, different people. It was different experiences, and it was a different movie. And And I think that that's always going to be the case. And it's part of the fun of what we do, mm-hmm. you know, is getting to like see films be different things in different places at different times.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I hear you. Since we've mentioned the holdovers, I am going to just say that I acknowledge that there has been of late a dispute has arisen over the screenplay to that film. We're not going to belabor that subject. I'm going to acknowledge it. Now we're going to move on. That is a good segue to sort of the other half of the equation of movie going. Exhibition. Obviously, exhibition. It's been a really tough season. Like, I don't think you could script worse business conditions for us, for a business, for an industry or a sector. What's the state of the art in exhibition, in the business of getting people to drive to the multiplex or to the theater and getting them in the door and hand, you know, all the things that we've been talking about, the process that can be so joyous when it goes well and, you know, not so when it's more of a struggle or the cost is an issue. What do you think, just in general, kind of what are your feeling about exhibition?
I actually think that it's fair and right to say that there's challenges there, of course, right? You know, but I actually think that the challenges, again, exist more on the spreadsheets, you know, than they do in reality, in so much as you know, there's a lot of screens in the country, there's, you know, high rents and leases, there's, you know, there's all of those challenges that are real. But I don't think anything is fundamentally different based on everything else I'm saying and like what the pathway to success is, that still I consider it to be very real, and that I think we as a business, being the studios, the exhibitors, working together to kind of craft, one, what the message of that experience is, but then to build the relationship into those local communities together in smart ways. I think we all continue to sort of like evolve and learn those lessons and work better together to really maximize what that relationship that a individual living in community X, Y, or Z can have with their local theater, you know? And I think as we learn those lessons and see that continue to evolve, it requires a different kind of work maybe than what we could all rely on before of just, yeah, people will show up because the theater is there and they'll pick the movie on the marquee that's playing at the time that, you know, like, is around when they arrive.
Right.
I think those days are probably behind us. Right. But I think if you look at what, for instance, again, to point to it again, what we did on Asteroid City, where, you know, here we are about to go into CinemaCon again. At CinemaCon last year, you know, the Landmark team came to us and said, hey, we have really exciting news. We're reopening the Sunset 5, you know, which literally was music to our ears.
Yeah.
And we thought that was it. We thought that was the exciting news. That was the conversation.
Because in a world where there's a lot of screens in this country, there's a real drought in Los Angeles.
That's
it's
right.
crazy.
Yeah.
But right. you were saying.
And what they then pitched to us was, you know, right now we're scheduled to open a week before Asteroid City comes out. But we have this idea that Asteroid City could be a major event for the audience of that theater that we would delay the week to open if you guys would work with us to create a full experiential wrap of the theater, you know, which truly was, we played all five screens, you know, for I think the first couple weekends of them reopening. The entire lobby was fully recreated to be Asteroid City. And it became this cultural, not only event, but actual physical destination for the kind of passions and energies of the Wes Anderson fans of LA to really rally around.
Right.
You know, and you saw a huge response to that, you know, and I think that it's going to be things like that that we all build and come up with together, which maybe don't have to be as big and grand as that, but certainly are the ideas that, you know, are acknowledging that it takes all of us working in unique ways to kind of harness an energy that is out there, but to get it focused, you know what I mean? To get it focused to like a specific time and a specific place in a world where, again, the dominant narrative of humanity these days is no one has any focus anymore at all about anything at any time in any place, because, you know, everything is just kind of available and hitting you, and you're getting notifications here and this is pinging you there, and all those things. So it truly is a game of the psychology of specificity of time and place being a meaningful experience for a community, that I think is going to be what wins the day for all of us getting, you know, back to truly what I believe will be where we were.
In the volume of ticket sales.
Yeah, exactly. In this space and beyond. We feel very, very fortunate as Focus being part of the overall Universal family, right? Because it kind of gives us this superpower of existing within what I consider to be the best current business model in the film business, of preserving the primacy of the theatrical release as the key cultural moment for the movie, right? But being smart to, you know, the new world of attention spans and windows and things like that, and having, you know, our premium VOD come along a few weeks later rather than a few months later, having, you know, the pay TV windows, you know, start maybe a bit sooner than they were in the past and things like that. I think
those marketing dollars, which just makes sense in this world.
Exactly. But all driven first and foremost from the notion that it is the cultural moment and the kind of the metabolizing of a movie into the broader ether as a theatrical experience first, right? That then lifts everything else up so meaningfully and creates a sense that this movie will then exist for years to come.
And we've been talking mostly about the domestic box office, but I would love your perspective on international, which for so long had been seen, I know, as like, you know, international is going to save Hollywood. International is you know, if a movie's on the border, international will kick it over to the, you know, to the successful side of the ledger. Do you still see that as, or was that too simplistic an equation for how Hollywood exported its product? I'm talking specifically, obviously, I know there's a very robust world of global cinema, but I am talking about, you know, Hollywood exporting titles overseas. What's going on there?
Well, I'll say a few things. I'll say, I think any one of us who's ever worked in the international side of the business.
And you work for Universal, big Universal, on the international side of
things. Well, sort of both. The first 10 years of my time at Focus, when we became Focus after being sort of Good Machine and USA Films and all that, was doing international sales. So I literally became the junior international sales guy and, you know, was fortunate to be able to work my way up, and had done, by the end of 10 or 11 years of doing that, sold movies to literally every country in the world and every kind of distributor of independent distributors in the world and things like that. And the lesson from that happens pretty early on, and you know, even on the studio side, when I was then doing acquisitions and buying a lot for international and things, is it's always kind of oversimplified in the broad Hollywood mindset, just even represented by calling it domestic and international. Right. Because, boy, you learn real quick that, like, there is no such thing as international. That is a blanket umbrella term that covers a ton of different countries with different cultures and different appetites
Germany,
and different
Japan,
ways
right.
of distribution and different laws that, you know, have different windows. All these things are
literally laws.
Yeah. Yeah. These are real and they're important. And again, they're ingrained into the kind of like DNA of the movie going habit in all of those individual territories, for sure. So I think if you then say, okay, where are we now in that? Actually, I mean, again, certainly in our space, in the specialty space, there's a lot of success stories. If you look at, I'll cite us again as the first example. If you look at The Holdovers, where we have a good playbook that we sometimes run with our partners on the Universal International side, who are, again, fully baked into the DNA of our company. It's not like we sort of do a domestic release and then throw a briefcase with the poster and trailer over the wall and see what happens with those guys. I mean, they fully are part of how we buy our movies, how we, like, you know, read our scripts, how we discuss what movies we should be making, and then building a global release strategy to them. And the notion that we start a movie here sometime in the fall, in the case of Holdovers, it was late October and platformed up through November, while deliberately holding back on any international releases until January and letting sort of that perceived possible awards momentum turn into actual real awards momentum, you know, and then you can get a real, you know, sort of pop on a movie that otherwise might have gone out earlier internationally and been digested as a bit more of a kind of like American boarding school, you know, what is that? I don't think that would have been the case here because of what the movie was, but you know, you're sort of like trying to like philosophize it in a holistic way. And then they really overperform and actually have grossed, I think, $24, $25 million internationally, which is a phenomenal number for that movie and puts us, you know, at, you know, 45 or something like that, 40, maybe more, even close to 50 as a global box office number. Look at Poor Things, another great example, right? You know, of like the international number on that movie was very, very strong, you know, and I think put that movie up near $100 million of global box office, which mm-hmm. is a huge success story in the space,
yeah.
You know, and et cetera, et cetera. There's a ton of those examples of, I think, for us in the specialty space, we've always had this sort of knowledge of there is a robust audience here in the US and, you know, the domestic marketplace with Canada that has a voracious appetite for this kind of movie. And we've got a good relationship with them. We flow with them. We sometimes try to, you know, get a movie to break out beyond them into the kind of broader commercial audience that will sort of go into the space and things like that. But internationally, there's a lot of places where that kind of ethos, that sort of like thoughtful cinema from an auteur director is much more naturally a mainstream kind of aesthetic.
Right. Let me ask you, my last question for you is, I love to ask people, in the job you have now, is there an experience early in your career or in your education or in your life, anything that you can think of that you look back on and think that was great training for the job I have now? Anything that stands out to you in terms of just an early experience that now you look back and like, that was a good experience or training or a good lesson learned?
It's a great question. And I'll maybe answer it more generally than you're asking it, because I can't think of the one specific story of this experience, but I can say that my entire career has been built on, you know, candidly, the shoulders of giants who I feel lucky to have learned from. And, you know, there's a reason I've always been here. You know, I you know, it was Good Machine was bought. We became Focus Features. I had that job. Donna brought me from Focus to Universal, but I was still working closely with Focus and then back to Focus and all of that. And every single step along the way where there was maybe an opportunity to look elsewhere, things like that, I never wanted to do it because I knew I was among people like James Seamus, like David Lindy, like Donna Langley, who really took seriously the idea and responsibility that if you're doing this job well, it's actually it's a service job. You know, it's a job of acknowledging that what you are doing is helping a filmmaker unleash their vision into the world, helping them shape what the kind of cultural moment of what it is they've created can be in the world, and being a meaningful partner in that, being, you know, someone who's not afraid to sort of push back on some ideas or things like that, but ultimately not treating it as we're here to generate, you know, a slate that's built on a spreadsheet. We're going to find the people who do that and they're going to do it our way or not. Like that has just never been the ethos of anything that we've ever done. And I think by keeping myself in the domain of people who constantly taught me that lesson and taught me ways to approach those individual situations that you face in a job like this, that's defined the entirety of what we've done since I've been running Focus, because it was the reason Focus was founded. And, you know, I think is part of the longevity of what we've been able to achieve here is it's not built on some sort of strategy deck business plan, right? As much as
quarter to quarter.
Yeah, yeah. As it's built on the kind of continuum of artistry and the evolution of artistry that happens naturally in the world and providing a home and a safe haven for those artists to come in, you know, and tell that story that they want to tell in their way. You know, that becomes the key thing that you are sort of operating in service of.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for listening. Be sure to leave us a review at Apple Podcasts and Amazon Music. We love to hear from listeners. Please go to Variety.com and sign up for the free weekly Strictly Business newsletter. And don't forget to tune in next week for another episode of Strictly Business.